All right, good morning to everybody. We're just about to start today's class. This is a little under a minute. Continuing with Kohelis, chapter 3. And we're up to verse 18. I'll show you just a moment. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you doing?
Hey, Doug. How are you doing?
Good morning, Rabbi. Good morning, Doug.
Hey, Rivka.
Good morning.
Hi.
There's a whole gang on the phone.
Hey, good morning.
It's a hot one today in New York.
Yeah, it is too.
Yeah. How are you doing, Doug?
Very well. And you?
Good. Thank God. Thanks.
Good.
By the way, I got a response back. I inquired from my sheikh, because I was talking to Rabbi Mann last week regarding the issue of whether to suggest, as I was doing, for a Noachai to convert, even though it's clear that the full system of the Torah, the 613, is definitely superior than less, which is just plain sense. Rabbi Chait came back to me this morning and said that you cannot encourage somebody who's not Jewish to convert. That has to be done internally. So I have to withdraw. I apologize for that, because I was actually encouraging that last week. So one thing, I have to separate the two. I have to separate between just outlining what is, you know, the different types of lifestyles, which one is superior, which is not, which is less. But the other point, in terms of encouragement, that has to be an internal process. So I wanted to bring that, apologize for that, and just make that clear, that that something has to be done internally. It can't be something which a Jew shouldn't go over to somebody who's not Jewish and encourage it.
Rabbi, did in that discussion, did any specific reasons come up that a Noahide should consider internally as reasons for them to convert or not to convert?
No, I did have a more lengthy discussion with Rabbi Mann over the week. Rabbi Chait's response was just very, it was a one-sentence response. That was that you can't encourage them, that has to be internal. That was Rabbi Chait's response. Rabbi Mann was saying that you have to, you know, he said for sure, you know, the Torah system is the system of perfection, and that's the Noachite system is just the minimal system for existence. So clearly, the increased system offers a human being much greater perfection. That's for sure. But there's also, Rabbi Mann mentioned that the specifics in every individual case. So in order to suggest, even on itself, to another person, you don't really know if the person can abide by it, and maybe it's the person just really can't do it. So that itself, but that's even after the fact, though. That's really a moot point, because based on what Bichet's saying, the suggestion itself is wrong. You shouldn't even suggest it, let alone the considerations of not even knowing how if a person can abide by all the laws. And would they be able to, you know, follow through, or would they fail? So there's those considerations too, which are great considerations.
Rabbi, what if the person, what if a Noahide or any other person wants to come to a rabbi or whoever and ask that they're interested in learning the Torah and they're interested in maybe making a conversion? At that point, the rabbi is not allowed to encourage? Is that what you're saying?
No, I was talking just about even before that point.
Before
the point of the Noachide even expressing interest, it would be wrong for another person to encourage it, because that decision has to be internal. Encouraging it externally, it makes sense, because now that can, you know, blur the lines. That can make it unclearer what the real intent is for the person to convert.
Okay.
So it has to be genuine, 100% genuine.
Okay.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Doug, was your question answered?
Okay.
Yes, it was. Thank you.
Okay. And I see that Naomi from India was trying to get on at 8:30. Right now it's 11:20 our time, so it looks like 8:30. Should I just send her an email? Hopefully she'll be getting us, so she knows to log on now. So it looks like they know how to get into the program now, which is good.
Yeah, I hope so. They're about, it's either 11 and a half or 12 and a half hours different from us.
I think, Josh, you said it's 8:30 their time now, right?
If I remember, that's what I figured, yeah.
Yeah, but 8:30 p.m.
But I went to some website and did like a, you know, where you can type in the time or whatever, and I think that's what it came up with. Yeah, it'd be like 8:45, I think, actually. 11:15, I think, would be like 8:45 at night.
All right. Essentially, I thought that the minutes are the same everywhere across the globe, simultaneously. It's just the hours are different.
I believe that. India's got like it's a half-hour difference.
Right.
But it's kind of unusual. Yeah, usually it's even hours, but...
Okay, hopefully they'll be able to join on, and Laura just joined from Washington. How you doing, Laura? Okay. All right, so let's go ahead. Now we're up to, so a lot of the verses that we had up to now are pretty clear. I think we only had very few that were a little bit difficult to read, but the next one we have is difficult to read. And that is chapter 3, verse 18. Okay, let's read to the end of this chapter now. Doug, you have the English there?
Yes, I do.
Okay, let's take it away. So 18 until the end of the chapter.
18 to the end of the chapter reads, I said to myself that this is because of the children of men, so that God should clarify for them, so that they may see that they are like beasts to themselves. For there is a happening for the children of men, and there is a happening for the beasts, and they have one happening, like the death of that one. And all have one spirit, and the superiority of man over beast is naught, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all came from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows that the spirit of the children of men is that which ascends on high, and the spirit of the beast is that which descends below to the earth. And I saw that there is nothing better than that man rejoice in his deeds, for that is his portion, for who will bring him to see what will be after him?
Right, who's going to bring him to make this decision? Okay, read it one more time, because there's a lot here, so let's read it once more.
Okay, I said to myself that this is because of the children of men, so that God should clarify for them, so that they may see that they are like beasts to themselves. For there is a happening for the children of men, and there is a happening for the beasts, and they have one happening. Like the death of this one is the death of that one, and all have one spirit. And the superiority of man over beast is naught, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all came from the dust and all returned to the dust. Who knows that the spirit of the children of men is that which ascends on high, and the spirit of the beast that which descends below to the earth? And I saw that there is nothing better than that man rejoice in his deeds, for that is his portion. For who will bring him to see what will be after him?
Okay. So the majority of what he's talking about seems to be a comparison between man and beast. Like he says, that man is really not elevated above the beast at all. So therefore everything is futile, because he says there's going to be one event that happens in verse 19. Okay, one event happens to man, and one event happens to the beast. One event happens to both, and just like, when, what is that event? Like, this one dies, that one dies, and they both share the same spirit. And man is really no more advanced than the beast. It's interesting. I mean, man is speech. Then he goes on, and then he talks about everything goes to one place. So we'll have to define what the difference is, because he's making two comparisons between man and animal. One comparison is in 19, another comparison is in 20. What's the difference between the comparisons? What's the additional element? And then 21, he says, who knows? What's he adding here? Who knows? The spirit of man ascends on high, or if the spirit of animal descends and go to the ground. I mean, who says there's any difference? And then he concludes, and he says, therefore I've seen that there's no good from other than the fact that man should just be happy in his actions, because that's his portion. Because who's going to bring him to see what's going to happen after life? It's like an unknown. So just enjoy your life here, and that's it. And of course, without the commentators, it would be, wow. How could the wisest man, one of the wisest men ever, say such things? But it's important, and we've been saying this all along, is that when he speaks, he is verbalizing the views, the false views of people, in order to catch the ear of the reader. And it's exactly what Ibn Ezra says here on verse 19. He says, this verse is reiterating the thoughts of people that are not wise and are not understanding. Because when they see that there's one happening to man and to beast in life and in death, they think that there's only one spirit to both of them. And there's no addition. Man is not elevated, and he's no superior, no more superior than the animal. Okay, so Ibn Ezra clearly is showing you that this is not his opinion. This is not King Solomon's opinion. But as we said many times, he's verbalizing the opinion of the foolish people to get the theists to read and say, yeah, that's right, that's what I feel. Because once you can only correct a person's flawed opinion if they admit that they have that opinion. So the way you get a person to admit an opinion, you verbalize it yourself. Oh, it gives them comfort now. Oh, this person's got the same, view that I have, that I've kept quiet all this time. Now I can come out verbally and say it because I feel security in the fact that somebody else shares my position. Now I'm not embarrassed to say that I have this view. So let's say you drag it out of the person, and then you say, no, that's wrong. I was only saying it as a lure to get you to admit that you have this opinion. Now let's together decide whether this opinion is true or not. But first you have to bring out the opinion. All right, so you see the strategy that the king uses?
Yep.
Okay. And of course the first verse in this series is, I said in my heart on the matter of man, the children of men, that God has selected them out. Ibn Ezra says that he has, selected them from all others. Liros Shehem Behamlehem, to show them that they should see that they are like animals to themselves. Now, what does that mean? It's a tough verse. So Sforno says that introduce this verse. He says, it's told to us in the Torah, in Genesis, that God created man in his image. Everybody's familiar with that verse, right? Let us create man in our image, God says in Genesis. Or in his form. What does that mean? Meaning having intelligence. And this was stated in order that man can choose for himself the intelligent life, the portion of God. That's why it's called, like Shimon said, God wanted to show how important that part of us is, that he named it by his own name. Selem Elokim. Elokim is God. Is God. Selem in Hebrew is form. So form of God means that we have a form that we can perceive ideas from God. Doesn't mean that there's a piece of God like people foolishly think. It means that God, because God created man, so clearly it wasn't made from a previous existing, a previous existence. So the fact that God created our soul, which we say in the prayer book every day, the Siddur, we say every day that the soul that you created in me is pure. So we can't say the words that you created my soul unless it was a creation from nothing. Foolish people think that this God took a piece of himself and put it inside man, but that's heresy, because you're now attributing division to God. There's no such thing as division unless you're talking about a physical object. Division can only take place when we're discussing physical things that can be divided into pieces. But something which is not physical is not subject to division. So therefore, they can't be a part of God in a human being. And clearly, the Torah tells us that he created man. And the Siddur says it also, that he created our soul. But the fact is that he named the soul the form of God, meaning it has the potential to understand the truths about God. So what's the king's point over here? What is King Solomon's point over here? He says, I said in my heart on the matter of the children of men that God selected them out, selected them clearly, is that he raised them above. I believe that's what the Ibn Ezra says. He selected them from all of the generations, or all of the creations of the earth. But Ibn Ezra says that the King Solomon is saying, but he sees that people treat themselves like animals. God, on the one hand, selected us. God selected us and made us different. He gave us the ability to think. But people do not do that. They equate themselves to the animals. That's what he says. God, on the one hand, gave us the option to choose the good. Okay, that's smarter.
So he's saying God gave us the option to behave like animals, or to behave at a higher level?
Well, he gave us the option to behave to a higher level, of course. He says, Sforno says, V'lirosheim behemahem lehem, and in order that they should see for themselves, and from their own, by themselves, they should see that they are living beings, aside from the fact that they have the selim, besides the fact that they have the soul, that they are like animals too. Meaning it seems to be that he's saying that God gave us, he created a situation where man is now put into a dilemma to choose. He says that God gives the ability to choose the spiritual life, the life of wisdom, and that they should also see that they have the animal side. That man should see for himself that they are they have an existence which is identical to an animal as well, aside from the intelligence. It's a little difficult even reading this morning. He says, let me see again. Meaning, aside from the intelligence, we are animals. And this plays a role in terms of a person's view. And it creates a problem. And what's the problem it creates? The problem it creates is that a person will now say, verse 19, There's one event that happens to man and beast. Just like this one dies, that one dies. And we both have the same soul. But that's what you see was the mistake. Because they're making an error. We'll have to get down to why they make this error. But man does say this. And again, keep in mind that this is verse 19, as Ibn Ezra said, is the expressed opinion of people, but it's, you know, King Solomon expressing the opinion of the foolish people. Again, he says, this verse is on the thoughts of man who are not wise and are not understanding. Because when they see that one event happens to man and to beast, they think that there's only one soul to both. And there's no other superiority to man because of that. And again, this goes back to the point we've kept on saying that it's only because the foolish assessment that people make, they limit their assessment to what they see on earth. Right? We said that a number of times. And that's why they have a false view. So the one view that they make here is they say that there's one soul. Okay? And you see clearly that the last verse in this series, which is 22, he says at the end, who's going to bring a person to see what happens afterwards? Meaning he's speaking to a very flawed opinion of man, that since man feels he's not, nobody can show me what's going to happen afterwards, so because of that, he excludes that completely from his equation as to whether or not man and animal is any superiority, and now he just assesses the value of man and animal just purely based on what he sees, right? Since death happens to both, therefore they're equal. Because of that, he makes... Go ahead.
Just saying that, if it weren't for the Torah to tell us that, if you look around, like anybody who doesn't know Torah would, like, why, it would seem logical to assume that we're just like the animals, because we don't know if it weren't for the Torah to tell us otherwise.
Right, you're right. And that's exactly what I think the Sforno was saying, that God said in his Torah, this is on the Sforno on 18. I'm not sure if there's a Sforno in English on this. You can check it out. But if there is, you know, it's a good idea to pick it up, because he's just a really, you know, very clear, brilliant person. So he says, he said in, who's that, Francesca?
Yeah, that was me.
Right. So it says, Sforno says what you're saying, that it was told over in the Torah that God created man with a form that he can perceive God. Meaning, the Sforno is saying, why did God tell us this in the Torah? Exactly to your point, because without that communication, you see all these people out there, animal lovers, you know, you see somebody, there was a time, I don't know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, everywhere you've seen a bumper sticker, I break for animals. To this day, I've never seen a bumper sticker that says, I break for humans. So you see there's this, you know, save the animals, save the whales, you know, you don't have to save the humans, you don't have anything, I mean, you do have movements, but it just brings to the point, like, that without that, people identify with the animal world and pets, and they love pets, and they care about them, and they project onto them feelings and so on. And they do, but they raise them to a level of their own equality. And they don't lower themselves to being like an animal, they say the animal's like us, you know, intelligence and all. But because of that, and because there may be a mistake, and there is a necessity for the animal kingdom, I mean, God made it for a reason. So man evidently has his identity with animal. I mean, that's what King Solomon is underlining over here, that there is a phenomenon in the world where we don't ignore the animal world. We see it, and there's a certain identity we have with it. We say, they're so similar to us. And, you know, we're really just like, you know, they die, we die, and that's it. And we tend to believe that we're just slightly different in terms of how we look, but that's about it. So God had to counter that by saying in his Torah that, no, you have something else called a Tzelem Elokim. You have an intelligence. You have a soul. Looking at the world itself, many people won't come to that conclusion. An intelligent person will, of course. An intelligent person doesn't need those words in Genesis to tell you that. I mean, Aristotle didn't study the Torah. He realized, you know, of course man has a soul and he can live eternally. But for the most part, people are not like that. people don't spend the time to think. So therefore, the Torah is given for the entire populace of the world. Therefore, it has to relate to everybody. You can't leave out the majority of people. So that was stated clearly in the Torah. God let us know we have this intelligence. Because yes.
So, I guess to take Francesca's point a little further, so God gave us the Torah, but if I set aside the Talmud, figuring that the written Torah is what most people will be able to have access to, at least easily, there's very little, if anything, said in the Torah about the world to come, and it certainly doesn't focus on the idea that there's another world after. It seems to focus heavily on here, now, and, you know, practical things.
Right.
So if God wanted to get that message across, wouldn't it seem like he would have been a little more direct about that?
Right, it's a good question. But this is a very good answer. And that is that, let's say God did have clear statements throughout the Torah about the next world. What that would do is it would shift a person's focus in life to the next world and thinking about what it's all about and imagining what he really can't know. And what he would be doing in the process is forfeiting the enjoyment of study just for the here and now. Now, if he forfeits that, he has no next world. Because the next world is really a continuation on a much grander level of the pursuit of wisdom. But if a person does not enjoy wisdom for the sake of wisdom while he's alive, therefore he hasn't trained his soul in what's necessary to enjoy the next world. It's like a person who's going to be in the Olympics and he doesn't exercise at all. So when he gets onto the starting line and they shoot the gun, he's not going to be able to run more than a couple of steps because he's completely overweight and out of shape. So he can't partake of the Olympics unless he's trained. So, similarly, the soul is not going to be able to enjoy wisdom if it never, in the next world, if it never came to really see it here. The rabbis say, a person who prepares for Shabbos will eat on Shabbos. What that means, it's a euphemism, it's an allegory. A person who prepares here will enjoy the next world, which they call as like an eternal Sabbath. Because Sabbath is a day of wisdom. So, God can't focus his Torah on the next world because that'll take it'll shift the focus away from wisdom here. So the Torah has to be, at almost every turn, just bring new ideas to our mind that just let us stop and think, hey, that's interesting. And we can appreciate the idea itself without any sense, any desire for reward. It's a very difficult thing to get into, that state, but you can do it. Because if you're always looking for the reward, then you're never going to really be immersing yourself in the wisdom just because you want to enjoy the idea. So it's the person who spends his time, like the Einstein, the Newtons, and I mentioned this also a few times, that they would, for weeks on end, just be in the lab and pondering and working out new theories just because it interested them. See, that's real love of God. That's really the perfection of man, where he's purely compelled to investigate the area because it's curious to his mind. His mind is, it attracts the mind. He's interested to know the answer to something. He wants to know how a certain thing works in biology or nature or in the Torah or in math. So that captivates the person and he has no greater enjoyment than that. He even goes for hours and he even sacrifices the pains of hunger because he doesn't want to pull himself away from what he sees. It's really so alluring. So it's that person who comes to a real pure enjoyment of wisdom that will enjoy the next world because he's spent his time valuing it and seeing it and becoming attracted to the wisdom that God has unveiled to us. So that's why the Torah has to be focusing purely on the ideas, one idea after the next, ideas that are beautiful that we enjoy. Through that process, a person will earn the eternity of a soul. But if a person is confronted with a Torah, and every other page talks about the next world, So now it's throwing his mind into a fantasy state, which he can never understand what it is, because you don't know what the next world is. You only know this world. So you're going to be imagining about the next world, not spending the time necessary in wisdom, and you'll get neither. You will not enjoy this world because you're stuck in a fantasy. You know, what's that next world all about? And you're not training your mind. So finally, when a person passes away, the soul has never been cultivated to the point where wisdom became a pure enjoyment. Like King David says, the Torah was like a plaything to him. Like a child has a new toy, is excited, completely magnetized by it. So to answer your question, that's why the Torah can't really make that a focal point. I hope it's clear.
That is. Thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah. And that's the problem, you know, it's one of the problems here in this series of verses, is that a person is convinced that all he sees is what goes on here. And it's very interesting. He gives you more clues. If you look at 19 and 20, take a minute and tell me why he has to write verse 20 also. What addition is he giving me in verse 20 that he did not mention in verse 19 regarding how man is forced into this mistake he makes about total equation between him and the animal? What does he talk about in 19?
Like in,
go ahead, Josh.
It seems like in 19, you know, he's saying, you know, they all have the same faith that the same event happens. You know, there's this event of death. But then in 20, it's making the jump to they all go to the same place.
Okay. Good, good distinction. Meaning in 19, he's saying there's an event. He says the word event three times. There's an event, one event for man, one event for animal, and there's one event for both. Just like this one dies, that one dies. So that's the event he's talking about, death. Now that's a very strong argument to a person who's not well studied. He's going to look at that event, and to him, this is how he equates the two, you know, the species of man and the species of animal. And he makes the equation based on the end of their existence, which is a mistake. So that's one way a person makes a false equation. He looks at what he assumes to be the final state. The final state, this is eventually what happens. This is where life culminates. And it's not bad. If it was true, it wouldn't be a false statement if it was true, because yes, how something ends can, you know, affect the value that the thing really possesses. But then he makes a statement, because of that, therefore, what I see in terms of the event of death, therefore, the soul also is the same. That's the mistake they made. For Ruach Echad, you see that? He says that. Just like this one dies, that one dies. And there is one spirit to both. He makes a jump. The foolish person now makes a jump. He now bases the nature of the soul purely on the event of death. But that's a mistake. You see that? The person makes a jump. And then he says, therefore man is no more superior to the animal. In 20, he adds on to his error. Because now, again, he's looking at where the body lies in the ground. Again, he's looking at something which he shouldn't be looking at alone. He's excluding other considerations. All he looks at in 19 is the event of death. All he looks at in 20 is the place in where the body lies. All go to the dust. The only reason why he makes that false statement, and again, King Solomon is here verbalizing the foolish statements of man, like Ibn Ezra says. But the person is now making this false statement because he's assessing only what he sees. Only what he sees under the sun. But they're two powerful arguments, because these really hurt a person's sense of mortality. Because the event of death, and then the lifeless body that goes back to the dust. These are very strong emotional arguments that the person makes. So I just want you to see the difference in terms of why he adds the second verse, because they seem to both be impacting the person's sense of worth. You go from life, there's the transition from life to death, and then, since the person here, who the King Solomon is describing, is making this mistake, since he's so attached to the physical life, so therefore he says, look, the body is in the ground, just like the animal, because he thinks the body still is man. So that should show you what this foolish person assesses as really man, but that is not man. Man is not the body. Man is the soul that continues. But he does go on at 21, and then he verbalizes the uncertainty that the person has. He shifts back to the word spirit, because you see, 19 talks about the spirit. 20 talks about where the person goes, into the dust. And he repeats the word dust in that verse, in order to show you that that's the thing to focus on. But then he goes back, and I don't know why yet, that he says in 21, and who knows the spirit of man, whether it goes up, or the spirit of animal, that it goes down into the earth. But Ibn Ezra tells us that at the end of the book, King Solomon says openly that the spirit of man does go up to God. That's in his conclusion. Right now, he's verbalizing the false views of people. So the false views of people are, they say, well, who knows if the spirit goes up? Or it's like the animal, if it goes down. Who knows how it happens? And when he says in 22, and I've seen that there's no other good than if a man should just enjoy his actions, Ibn Ezra says again, this is just talking about people, that there is, this is talking about people that think that they are just like animals. So therefore, if that's all they think, so all they really have is this life. Because they have no other portion, according to their false opinion. So therefore, why should they involve themselves in things that they're going to forsake? Why should they involve in imaginary things like Torah and things like that if they really think that their end is on earth, and that's it? So when he says here in 22, again, he's again verbalizing the false opinion of people. When he says that for these people, that all they think is the physical life, so really the only thing good for them is to enjoy their actions, because that's all they think they have. If they really feel that there's nothing in the next world, so then what's the use for them to be involved in wisdom? What use is it for them to prepare themselves? In their estimation, it would be a foolish thing. So again, he's trying, this one here, he's verbalizing, and he ends off without giving a corrective statement here, according to Ibn Ezra.
But 22 is a continuation of that, not a true statement about reality.
Correct. So he doesn't come back after 22 and then tell you what the real thing is. The point of Ibn Ezra, at least. Right, because he ends off verbalizing that a person's going to say, who knows, because who's going to bring me to see what happens afterwards? Since I can't see it, so the person is now making a conclusion based on ignorance. Because mi yodea, he says, who knows? Who knows means that there's no answer. 21 says, who knows whether this, the soul of man, whether it goes up to heaven, or if the spirit of the animal actually goes down into the earth, into the ground. But he's telling you that people are unsure, and they're living their life and making these very, lethal choices based on ignorance, because they don't know. They haven't come to a conclusion, and still they're making a decision. Still the saying that man is no better than animal. But he shows you that it's based on a foolish thing. They don't know. He's saying they don't know. So therefore, in a way, he is telling you that this is wrong. He is coming to a conclusion, because he's predicating the fact that they make all these decisions, that man is no greater than an animal. man has the same event of death as an animal, and man goes to the grave just like an animal. And this is all based, however, on the fact that he says in 21, who knows what happens? Who's going to bring me to the afterlife and show me? So in a way, he is showing you that this type of assessment is foolish, because it's all based on ignorance. It's based on people who don't know. So in that sense, he is showing you that it's a false assessment. But clearly you see that he's giving you insight into how there's a number of things here. One main idea is that, like Francesco was saying, looking at, because man identifies with the animal world, he's going to think this is a great equation between man and animal, that we're identical almost. And that comes from a certain identity, a certain need for friendship, or a certain need to feel befriended by an animal. A lot of times people have pets, it's because they imagine that the pet is giving them love. So it's really a selfish type of a thing, and they feed them, and they walk them around, they go through great measures, but they don't stop to think what's the real motivation behind it. There's an imagined company, a good reason to have a pet. It could be because it's good for your child, Rabbi Chaya once mentioned that the species of the dog is the one animal that's really created for man. And you see that they are, there's bloodhounds, and there's ones that know how to sniff out the human, they can save life, and they can pull a sled, and they do a lot of things. They're dogs that are like, you know, they're watchdogs, or shepherd dogs, so there's so many functions for man. So there is a realistic benefit to the animal world, specifically the species of the dog, the canine. But there is also the fact that there's the identity that people have, and because of the identity, these mistakes come up. And now that we see that an animal dies and a man dies, because I've created such a close tie and identity with the animal kingdom, I now make an equation that I have the same end as the animal. And not only do we both die, but now where is the body resting after death? That, since a person can't detach themselves from the body of a person, meaning when the person's friend dies, it's the body. They can't realize, and it's difficult, because it's the body, it's the face, it's the smile, all these things affect the person in life, and that's what they felt the person is. But a person who's an intelligent person knows that that's just the vessel that the soul was housed in during this earthly existence. But the real person is no longer on earth. The real person is now in a very blissful state, a very enjoyable state if you live the right life. Okay. So it's interesting insights he's giving us here. And where the person will be led to make mistakes, and what motivates him, and what bothers him, the event of death, and the body lying in the ground just like an animal. It's interesting that when God had punished Adam and Eve, so he said one of the punishments was that he was now going to eat from the grass of the field. And the Talmud states because there's a problem in the verses. The verses say that you're going to eat from the grass of the field, and then it says after that, you're going to eat bread by the sweat of your brow. So which one is it? Is man now doomed to eat grass, or is he now going to eat bread? So the Talmud says that initially he was going to eat grass. There was going to be a demotion of man's status, and now he would have to eat just like the animals. But Adam said to God, I can't take this. I can't be just as low as an animal, that I'm going to share the same eating trough as my animal and eat grass just like him. So God said, all right, I'll make a concession. I'll allow you to eat something which is elevated. But you'll have to work, and that work, I guess, is going to allow man to feel a certain industrial feeling about himself, that he can labor, and he's creative, and he accomplishes something in the creating of bread, and it sets him apart from the animals, so it placated his ego. But you see an interesting thing, though, is that there is a sense in that Adam had, the animals were much below man. He didn't want to share the same lot as the animal. But Ibn Ezra says that Adam was a great intellect. See, he saw the distinction. Perhaps King Solomon of here is again, like he said, he's talking about the opinions of people who are not wise. They're not understanding people. So therefore, they make this error, and they look at animal and man very closely tied. Okay, let me stop here. Any questions or comments?
Rabbi?
Yes, Gal. How are you?
I'm fine. When we studied the Torah and we learned about the different tribes, and I think there was Gad and Naphtali that showed the example of one tribe that studied and the other tribe that engaged in trade and things. It seemed like there was a benefit to each, that they each supported each other. This seems to talk about more the individual, in that we all have a responsibility to develop our minds and our souls. And I guess I'm a little bit confused as far as the one that is involved in the trade, even though they learn, does that mean they have a lesser place, or... the relationship, the support that elevates man.
Right. Well, it's a good question. I mean, the supporters of Torah, and I believe it was Yisachar and Zebulun that you're talking about, not Gad and Naphtali.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Zebulun was like they were worked the ships. I think Yisachar was had studied, if I'm not mistaken. It's a good question. I mean, the real benefit is in the intellectual perfection. So how do they share the lot if they're not really involved in study? Well, I mean, the bottom line is they still have to be involved in study, because you have to keep the Torah. And you have many, many commands. In order to keep the command, the person has to study and know what they are. So they could not be completely exempt from study. I mean, Torah study is the greatest of the 613 commands. So there is also the idea of a person who supports Torah, that then he recognizes the value of it, he supports it monetarily, so there's a great reward to that. I remember Rabbi Rosenfeld was mentioning to me that he was always involved in fundraising, and he found a statement by Rambam, by Maimonides, that said that a person who coerces others to give charity, the person who does the coercion is a greater reward than the actual person who gives. So perhaps because he's the real catalyst for it coming about. I mean, with the real efficient cause for Torah to be in the world, if Zebulun is working and supporting their brother so they can be involved in Torah, so there's a great share that they have in that. They see the value. And you know, people are different. You know, one person could learn an hour a day, and that's the saturation point. Another person, like Moshe Feinstein, it's not like he can learn 18 hours a day. And there's no... it's not a competition. Like Maimonides says, everybody could be like Moses. How could you be like Moses? The Torah says openly at the end that nobody could be like Moses. And Maimonides says you can be like Moses. It means to say that you can reach your potential just like Moses did. And that way you're equivalent to Moses. So it's God's will if a person's born like an Einstein or like a Moses or like an everyday person like one of us. So then that's God's decision. That's how, it's nothing we can do about that. We can only actualize our potential. And then we're living the best that we can. And God gives reward based on that. So there's a lot of things that go into the equation. So all things being equal, though, if two people are equal and one person is less involved in wisdom than the other, so of course the person who's less involved in wisdom is going to be accomplishing less. But all things are not equal. You know, two people are, you know, distinct. Very much so. Person has to know themselves. They have to know, you know, they have to, you know, try to advance their ability. Remember, somebody once quoted Robert Chase talking how a person slowly, when he gets involved in study, he learns a little bit longer, and he learns a little bit longer, and he builds up. So there's something a person can do to actually increase his capacity. But the truth is, when a person gets to the point that they really enjoy it, and they value it, and that's really the nature of the soul, is they're really drawn to wisdom, that's really the goal. So Thomas says, it doesn't matter whether you learned a lot or you learned a little, provided that your learning was pure. It was purely because, like we said in the beginning of the class tonight, that the attachment to the wisdom is really the most important thing, that you really value it. This really affects your soul. Your whole nature is different now, that you value wisdom not for any reward in the next world. You value the wisdom because you see it as being interesting. It's compelling. So that's the real attachment to wisdom, and it's pure. It's not for any other ulterior motive. The rabbis say you should not serve God in order to get a reward. You should serve him like a person not to get a reward. Meaning just do it because you see that, recognize the value, and it'll be something which you enjoy. God created us a way where we have the capacity to have an immense and the highest degree of enjoyment through appreciating ideas. That's really where a person could be most satisfied. There's no physical limitations. There's no, you don't get physically tired when you're studying. There's the bad weather can't ruin your learning like it can if you want to go play tennis. And or inclement weather is not going to destroy your learning like it can when you go on a trip and then it ends up raining for a week. There's nothing which can impede, because as long as you're conscious, and you are your whole life, you can think. You can think in areas, and you can. You can do it when you're hungry. You can do it when you're not hungry. But again, it depends on the person. So, but again, all things being equal, yes, a person who's not learning as much is going to not accomplish as much as a person who is. I remember Roy Chait saying once that there's certain people, they can become observant much later in life, and they obtain for themselves a portion of the world to come. And then there's a person who's studying their entire life for decades. So he says, yes, both have a share in the world to come, but what type of portion does a person have who only did it, you know, for a year at the end of his life? Compared to a person who's been spending his whole life in pursuit of wisdom, the portion is completely, you know, it's a very, you know, large gap. But it is an interesting phenomenon. Anyway, it is an interesting phenomenon that they had that arrangement. Somebody had a question?
Yeah, Rabbi, I just wanted to comment. I remember asking you a question once in reference to this, and I remember it's so true what you're saying. The learning is for the benefit of the learning. It's not to get the reward, because when you do learn and you are studying on your own, whenever what part of the day, it seems that you can find yourself benefiting. It's a big gain. And it isn't like you're doing it for the reward. When you start doing it on your own, you sense what you're saying. I remember you telling me that, and I remember experiencing that. It is true.
Yeah, because when you learn...
Learning for the sake of learning and developing your own neshama, rather than looking towards learning as getting a reward.
Right, because when you're learning for reward, you're not really learning because you want to enjoy the idea, so you're not learning.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So you're not absorbed in it as much. It's like you have, it's like any other ulterior motive.
Yeah.
You have something else on the sideline. You're not really completely in it.
Yeah.
And it makes all the difference. I found that to be very, very true.
That's true. That's true.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
I think that makes sense. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. No problem. All right. So, I think we'll wrap it for today then, and we'll pick up, we'll start chapter 4 next week. I may look over though, because I mean, I'm sure that there's much more here, so maybe we'll just review one more time what we did today, next week, and then we'll move on to 4. So just look it over also from what we read, you know, 18, verse 18 today until the end, and, you know, maybe make some inroads and read the first couple of verses in chapter 4, so we're prepared for both. All right?
Okay.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Good week to everybody.
Thanks, Rabbi. Thank you. Have a great week, too. Have a good week.
Thank you. Have a good week, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.